Yes. Oh, hi.
Hey, you know, it's, I know it's been a bit of a rough patch lately, but I needed to come by. And you know what? I'm here to say no hard feelings. You know, we can keep the ownership of the pod together. Okay.
You sure you don't want to talk to your lawyer before you have this conversation?
No. We're past lawyers, B. It's okay. Just you. Back to our roots. You and me together with this pod.
Okay.
And as no hard feelings, I've brought you a gift. See, I got you. See, behind me, very fancy hat box. You know, nice hat. I thought of you. Because you look at this. It's got a nice wide brim, big old feather. You'd be looking like Captain Barbossa with this bad boy. So why don't you go ahead and take the hat? Why don't you put that on? Why don't you put that hat on?
You want me to put it on?
Yeah, you can put it on. I think it'll look good. We could take
Jackson,
some pictures.
Is there a reason why it's rattling?
Oh, don't pay attention to that. Oh, that's probably just the
music feather's moving.
The music box, and it's a little automated. It's pimped out.
Jackson, you don't have the amount of money that you would need for an automated
hat. I saved up for you. How dare you?
Jackson, is there a snake in this hat?
Let's go. Hello!
Hello!
And welcome to a perfect sounding episode of Homegrown. Horror. Yeah, we started a recording, but we had to back out deal with audio issues.
Honestly, I feel like the fact that this has only happened to us once in the almost 2 years we've been doing this is actually quite good. I have I've heard podcasters talk about like, hey, we recorded the whole episode and we weren't recording, or we recorded the whole episode and it was garbage poo poo. Like the fact that this is the first time we've had to restart, I think is...
Well, the first time we've chosen to restart. There's some shitty sounding ones out there. I will not deny that.
Fair, fair, fair.
But we're always trying to strive for the best quality that we can get and see at the time. So that is key.
Here at Homegrown Horror, I am Bea, co-host.
I am Jackson, a co-host. Welcome to Homegrown Horror. We talk about true crime, cryptids, horror, ghouls, goblins, monsters. Trigger warning for today's episode, we will be talking about child murder. So if you don't want to listen to that, go ahead and check out the other wonderful episodes that we have available for you. B, how are you?
I am pretty good. I have been very busy. Started a new job, working on a show. Weekends are packed doing stuff, but I am about to be swimming in Amazon orders. And we are going camping this weekend.
Very exciting
and
stuff.
And I have to peace out early to do costume stuff. I'm sure most of you know by now, that is my life, is when a show starts, I become scarce.
The show grind is
the
real.
The show grind is real. And then, you know, we also did a mini con crunch right before PortCon this year, which was probably one of the crunchiest con crunches I've ever had.
Yeah, quite crunchy. But we had a great time. It was a lot of fun going out. You went 2 days, right?
Yep. Allegra.
You did an afternoon and then the full day.
Allegra and Emily picked me up for Friday, and mostly because, and then we met our friend Jade there. So we got to go meet Patrick Pedraza. I believe that's how you say his name, who plays the Wanderer in
Friend
Genshin
of the
Impact.
Show.
We talked about Stephen King, and he's a very chill dude. Allegra and I got an autograph and a print from him. He's super, super cool. And, you know, I told him I have a podcast, and he was like, oh, I'll give it a listen. If you are listening, Patrick, hi. I hope you enjoy all the Stephen King episodes.
And don't hide that talent in a bushel. Come on the pod sometime. We have no money to give you.
I would love for him to come talk about Stephen King. It was really fun talking to him. He was very nerdy, very horror nerd. So we did that, and then... lots of shopping.
Lots of shopping. The dealer's table. The dealer's room, they made off like bandits with B's lunch money.
It's true. At one point, our friend Jade was just sort of like, okay, no more money, because I said I had run out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, I hit, you know, because I did budget. I did go over budget.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah.
You usually give yourself a little bit of wiggle room.
And then you break that wiggle room.
And then you break that wiggle room. So Jade was like, remember, I was like, oh, I'm just going to go over here and look at Hammer Girl anime. And he was like, well, you don't have any more money, so you'll be fine. And then I came back with another figure. And he was like, what? I don't, what?
Always money in the banana stand.
He's like, I cut you off. And then Allegra's like, no, I really cut her off this time. But I've, you know, I in our previous recording, I said, Allegra and I have been going since 2007. I've learned many things in my time, which part of it is, How much do I realistically need to save? Because I know you said there were shiny things that you wanted, but
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was not. Also, you also unfortunately fell in this gap between when you get paid for your last job and your new job.
Yep. So I was like pretty broke. I'm still very broke. I'm counting the days down till payday, and I can eat something that isn't fucking rice. So very excited to get paid. But yeah, I went over to con, and Emily was super nice because she actually saved money for the con, so she was able to get something. And then she was very nice to me and said, hey, if there's something you want, you can let me know.
Don't you love it when your spouse is nice?
Yeah, I love really.
I feel that way with Emily too. Emily with Allegra, and it's just sort of like,
what are you saying about my spouse?
I don't know. I know nothing about your spouse as a spouse. Emily and I are secretly married.
Oh no! My life's a lie. No,
it is. It's always nice when you're not as fortunate. You know, your little bank account is a little dry and your spouse is like, hey, I know you wanted that thing. Like, you just won't let me get it for you. And it's like, surprise present out of nowhere. But speaking of gifts to the world, so way back, we talked about which case is it? I can't remember. It was your case.
Mary Catherine Olenchuk, actually.
Thank you, because there was another Mary Catherine that I did shortly after, and I could not remember which one it was. I knew it was yours. But so we had discussed at one point, we had been reached out to by a fellow who was putting together a documentary.
It's Bob Walsh, who was very much related to the Mary Catherine Olenchuk case, because he ended up becoming sort of a suspect, and also was wrongfully pinned a lot of blame upon when he was younger. He was only like 16 years old when this was happening, and he ended up, kind of becoming ostracized by his classmates and community because they're making a lot of jokes or just making assumptions that he was the murderer when in fact he was not. Very much proven that he was not, but you know what, how kids are like. So he's been very much involved with the case of Mary and has been out there trying to give evidence and trying to find like more like clues to follow up on. And also he went ahead and worked with the company to produce a film called Entangled Strangers, which is out now. He let us know about it. We knew that this was coming down the line for a while, but hadn't had any information. So Bob, thank you so much for letting us know about the case. And we'll be checking it out. And also, listeners, go ahead and check it out. It's available on YouTube, so it is free, you cheap bastards. But we're not talking about Mary Catherine Olenchuk today. You can go ahead and check out, again, it's Entangled Strangers. We're going to be talking about a different 1950s case.
Oh, we're going...
It's not actually. Ooh. That case wasn't from the 50s. But anyway, no, we're going but to the 50s.
No, I was going to say, I think that that's, you know, we either go really far back or it's pretty recent. I think we don't have.
We don't really go middle of the road very often.
I think the 50s is a not oft-traveled road for us.
No. Some people in America would call it the golden age of America, the 50s, you know, when black people couldn't vote. That's the great America, as some people say.
I don't care what you do. Just do it in the closet.
Other wonderful, things from that time. So we're going to be going to Grey Main. You familiar with Grey Main?
I am.
I'm familiar with Grey Main as a pass-through town for me. That, and probably a lot of Maine residents, actually.
The Grey's Animal Farm is there.
Grey's Animal Farm is there. Yes. Have you been?
Yes. It was a very, very long time ago. But yeah, so it's interesting because like it says animal farm, but it's like low-key kind of like a zoo.
Yeah, okay.
But not a zoo.
It's like a, it's middle of the road.
It's middle of the road, but yeah, we went there. Like, that was one of the things that you would do, like, an element. There was, like, a trip you'd take in elementary school. So that's, I haven't been as an adult.
Grey's a pretty interesting little community, you know? It's very small population-wise. It got 8,000 people, only about 46 square miles. In its early history, it got started around 1736. It burnt down twice, apparently, as I was getting started. I guess people just couldn't keep their damn lanterns off at night. Am I right? Snuff those out, you weirdos. Grey was also home to the first ever wool mill in America.
Yeah.
And also, you know, in this town, it's got, you know, like a couple of little attractions, a golf course. Not a whole lot going on. Very small town. What is unique about Grey, though, is that it is the intersection of a bunch of state routes. So if you're kind of traveling from the south to the north, you're probably getting very close to Grey or passing right through Grey to go to wherever you are. When you drive through it, you can tell that there's all these crossroads intersecting because you'll find one of the most annoying Mixmaster like roads that you'll get through. And it's like, yeah, no, there's like three things intersecting with each other and then spitting out into six other lanes. It's really funny. But we're going to be going back to the 50s here, and we're going to be talking about the unfortunate case of Daniel Kenneth Wood Jr. Daniel was born on October 30th, 1941, and around the time that the events are unfolding is 1954 in the summer. We're looking at actually June, it seems. He's only 12 years old. He's living with his family, so he's got a mother, father, three siblings. He's often called Danny, as any Daniel would. He, you know, 12 years old. Yeah, not really sure where he's at in his lineup of siblings.
And I know sometimes with these cases, like, the details
just
can
like,
be a little fuzzy or not there at all.
Well, I'm sure it's there. It's just that wasn't something that I looked up, which I should have. But oh, well, here we are.
Don't worry.
And we're on schedule. he was kind of tall. He weighed about 100 pounds. He wore glasses, so he did kind of stand out among a crowd. But he was a pretty scrawny kid. Like 12-year-olds are pretty scrawny, I think. And he enjoyed pretty much the basics that you would in 1950s, like good baseball, like to play some basketball. He was pretty into fishing as well. And in the summer of 1954, on this fateful, the afternoon or day of July 22nd, he was planning on going fishing with his friends, spend a little wonderful time outside, enjoy the time off until he has to go back to school. Daniel had run off out into the neighborhood with his fishing pole that morning, kind of like Leave It to Beaver, you know, it's whistling. Boop, 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 boop. And he
That's
was expected
the
to...
the Andy Griffith Show,
oh,
not
fuck,
Leave
you're
It to
right.
Beaver. I used to watch a lot of TV Land with my grandmother. Yeah.
I bet they still go. I feel like it's just always the same thing. Mm-hmm. Munsters was my jam.
I loved the Munsters and I love the Addams Family. I cannot choose. You will
not. Two quality programs.
You will not make me choose.
You will not make me choose.
I also love Gilligan's Island.
Daniel was pretty much out for the entirety of the day until Daniel's mother received a phone call from a nearby station that was about 3.5 miles away. Oh, Cornerstone, I'm sorry. Daniel called his mother and said that he had been offered a job with a door-to-door salesman making house calls for 50 cents an hour. Big no. The 50 cents an hour. Let's see how much that is.
While you're looking up the inflation for 50 cents an hour, something that is so interesting to me is, like, now we have the ability to put phones in children's hands and they can walk around, and we are more aggressively protective of them in terms of, like, I mean, it wasn't nearly as, like, I would say my childhood was middle of the road. Like, we would go and wander around. Like, Allegra's parents would let us, like, walk up to Lowe's to get pizza or, you know, even younger than that, we would disappear into the woods and nobody would, you know, as long as we came back by, you know, lunchtime or even dinner time, depending on who was watching us, you know, it didn't, nobody really cared so much. But then it started to get it, like, my sisters, I don't think, had that much of a free rein, you know, and now it's where we are today. But I think it's so crazy to think, you know, you had no way to contact your parent.
You were just gone.
Or your child. Yeah. There's even in situations where it's like, I'm a grown adult and I'm just driving down the highway. It's like, nobody knows where I am.
Yeah, yeah. That is true. Like, I mean, when I was younger, I didn't have a cell phone for a while. I think I didn't get a cell phone until I was 14 years old. And I think that's probably for the best, honestly. But I agree. Yeah, I wasn't a latchkey kid by any means. My parents really were pretty strict about when I needed to be home and who I was hanging out with.
Then again, like, I know you were young when you were in Mexico, but, like, they had the Mexico experience, so.
I literally could not leave wherever I was located when I came to Mexico without being accompanied by a bodyguard.
Yeah.
So that was my, definitely not a latchkey kid.
So what is 50 cents an hour in the 50s?
It's a little bit over $5. Kind of shit money, honestly.
But if you're 12?
If you're $12, I guess it's good.
Well,
I think, like, I guess, what is a 12-year-old going to buy? He's going to go buy some candy.
Yeah.
You know, $5.50, that's pretty solid.
$5, considering the fact that, like, up until recently, the state minimum wage was only $7.50.
Still $7.25 in some states.
Yeah. So there's that. I'd say that's not terrible money for a 12-year-old. Still not buying it.
Just a reminder, the federal minimum wage has not increased since the 70s. If you're thinking of moving to this country.
Yeah. If you're from out of this country.
So he's going to make 50 cents an hour, talking to his mother, assuring her he's going to be back home before sunset. He'll be back home for dinner. Well, as we can easily imagine, that did not happen. Daniel didn't return home. Dinner was getting cold. Daniel's mother and the family started contacting first all the friends that he could possibly be with just to see, is Daniel there? Where could he possibly gone? Nothing. They contacted everybody they could think of. Then they started contacting the police. The first thing the police did was go to the corner store where Danny had made his phone call. They talked to the owner. The owner was able to confirm that, yes, Daniel did make a phone call from the store, but wasn't able to give any other information. Did not see this traveling salesman that Daniel talked about. He ended up running up the street after leaving the store, and she did not see him get into any vehicle whatsoever. Daniel's father also made this realization that he was at a local filling station probably around the same time that Daniel was making the phone call, which was 200 feet away. So that weighed on him heavily. Something that's pretty awful from other details of the story is that this is a huge moment for the family. It's very rough on the parents. They don't get over it for their lives. As one sibling mentioned, it physically aged them, how stressed out it made them. And I mean, it's freaking terrible. So all we know of is this, there's this traveling salesman. So leads are being followed up on. They're trying to reach out to different neighborhood kids, anybody that would be able to give a better idea of who this might have been if they saw Daniel with anybody. One neighbor stated to the news that he had seen a, quote, flashily dressed man of around 50 years old near the Wood home that day. You know, kind of leaning into the idea that he was abducted. Obviously, he had been at this point.
Yeah.
One schoolmate of Danny, Donna, claimed to have seen Danny riding in a maroon sedan car near the Dry Mills school. She said she knew it was Danny because Danny had called out to greet her, and Donna had mentioned that he was traveling with a man, a woman, and two more children she didn't recognize. Plot thickens. There's some more people involved within this situation. So we were only aware of this. Donna had also mentioned that the car had yellow plates, which the police said was most common with vehicles seen from the Canadian province of Quebec. So we're dealing with maybe some international kidnappers, potentially. They were never able to, you know, verify this claim from Donna. Mm-hmm. But considering, you know, that she was very adamant that it was Danny, it's like she wouldn't be able to mistake it.
No, because
also Danny calling out.
He called out to her.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh, I saw him in passing. It's, we made some sort of contact. And if it's someone that you know, like, I'm not going to mistake one of my coworkers for somebody else if they call out to me and I, like, make pointed contact, eye contact with them.
Right. So July 22nd, you know, this is, that's when the event started, but nothing's coming up. None of the leads are, leads being followed up on are not leading to anywhere. There's some instances of seeing this man, but, you know, not really a good look at him. One call that did come in came direct to Daniel's mother, and was quite upsetting.
Oh, no.
Daniel's mother received a call from Manhattan in which a woman claimed Danny was with a man she knew from Alabama. The woman said that the man took children to a farm and was cruel to them, and that he drove a maroon Studebaker. So details were obtained from this woman, and there was some follow-up on it. But unfortunately, the police were not able to find any evidence of such a person, a place, or man of this description. And the police were forced to conclude the call was probably a hoax.
Ugh.
And it was just some asshole that had been calling in from local papers.
I don't understand those people.
It's so fucked up. It's like it's a grieving, it's a family that's looking for any little bit of hope, and you're gonna waste their time with this. It's like really fucking funny.
Yeah, I know. I've talked about it. I mean, when we've done ongoing cases and we've provided state tip lines and stuff like that, I know we always say, hey, don't do that, but it's because no, people really do that.
Yeah, it's true. And if you do that, we'll beat you up.
I'm going to take your lunch money.
We're going to take your lunch money and spend it on figures.
Yeah, so watch out.
So.
Oh, boy.
Some conclusion did come out of this. 9 days after Danny went missing, two fishermen from Freeport were picking their way along the banks of the Androscoggin River when they found the body of a little boy laying in the water. Mm-mm. With the shoelace tied around his wrist.
Was this in Gray or was this in Freeport?
Androscoggin River, probably near Freeport. A medical examiner, examined the body, as they do, and determined that the child had been savagely beaten around the head, probably with some wood object. They were able also to confirm that the body did belong to Danny. The force of impact was quite severe. We will not get into the details. Different articles of clothing were found in the vicinity as well. Danny's glasses were found in the branches of a tree. Different clothing items were found, you know, hidden in rocks and all this. What was interesting, though, is that this area and these different areas that they found the clothes were already previously believed to have been searched thoroughly by the police, leading the investigators to believe that the killer may have come back to store and remove the body at this point within this area.
Or
the police didn't do a good job. Possible there. We only have the investigator's word for it.
The other thing is, to be fair, also, if it's near... It was in the river? His remains were in the river?
His remains were in the river.
If the remains were placed somewhere else on the bank of the river.
Mm-hmm.
The river is a river. It's gonna river.
Within the river, they said they only really found, like, a sock. So it sounded like the clothes were kind of scattered in different locations.
Which makes sense, because the river would distribute them along...
But they weren't really along the... in the river. Okay. It was, like, in different wooded areas nearby.
Understood. Okay.
But it's like, it seemed like a mixed bag of like where everything was.
But their thought process is the remains weren't placed somewhere else and it came down river. Some of the items were nearby. So this is probably the location.
Potentially, it seems.
Okay.
Now, you know, they were able to find that, okay, Danny did pass. But they had no leads. There was nothing there, you know. There was no forensics at this time. They don't have any ability to take fingerprints. Also, it's unfortunate. Classic Maine in the summer. Lots of rain. Lots of other stuff was happening. There was some, like, belief that they had found, like, a broken shovel handle nearby that they believed that could likely have been the murder weapon. But they weren't able to prove anything. It was just kind of suspiciously placed.
I mean, also, this is the 50s. There's no DNA.
Yeah, well, blood was washed away. They did find other articles of clothing that seemed to have blood on them. But the crime scenes were pretty much contaminated at this point with a couple days of the rain washing away a lot of the evidence. There were a couple of follow-ups, you know, within this case. There was a couple of, like, different murderers or murders that had occurred that seemed to be targeting children in the area. One idea was this individual named Herman Barmore, aka Charles Fitcher, who was a child molester that was arrested in 1957 for the slaying of a Boy Scout. That scout was taken, abducted from a camp in Muskegon? Camp Wabaningo in Muskegon. Don't know where Muskegon is. In July 1955, and then that boy was found dead a month later. Barmore confessed to the murder and was convicted for second-degree murder. They thought that maybe Barmore was related, but they weren't able, of course, to get any decent information, and a little bit of the case was different. Peter, with the boy that was abducted, was shot in the head versus Danny, who was beaten. Another idea was a murderer named Lucien Picard, who may come up in a future episode. Not sure. I'll look into more of him. But he had abducted a six-year-old Raymond Trudeau in Canada on July 7th, 1954. The child's body was then later found in the waterfront of Montreal, dismembered and dumped into two cardboard boxes. But again, you know, it's like they followed up on this Picard lead because, okay, well, Donna said that she saw a vehicle with yellow plates. Could it have been related to this guy?
Yeah, that train of thought makes sense, yeah.
That did make sense, but, you know, nothing. There was some suspect as well of a traveling music salesman who was held in Sioux City, Iowa in 1954 in connection with the what?
Is this the fucking Music Man?
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
What?
He was connected to the abduction and murder of an 8-year-old boy named Jimmy Bremers. You know, he's kind of far from Maine at this time, but Jimmy was found mutilated and dumped in a field. And it seemed pretty similar in some parts of like how the body was found and the murder itself. So there was a lot of all this to say, there was a lot of follow-up from the police to try to look at the people who had already been committing similar crimes, but they are still not able to pin anything.
I also want to point out,
yeah,
because one of the things, you know, we like to think that things are more dangerous now than they ever have been. How many active killers did you just mention in this one frame of time?
Three, and all very awful.
And you that's know? Just, yeah, so like, and that's just related to this one case. I just want to put it out there that, like, I don't think the 50s were any safer. And I think most people who know true crime, like the 70s to the 90s, the Wild West when you're looking at true crime.
It's true, just, yeah.
It is absolutely crazy. But I posit, true crime has always been there. Just the documentation has gotten better.
Yeah.
And same I mean, with anything.
Our ability to follow up on leads, forensics is helpful. You know, and even some of these methods that we aren't super thrilled about, like lie detector tests and whatever. They to be still able did, to yeah. try to do anything to find some grain of truth within these cases can be helpful, but you know, relying on it too much is not going to be helpful to them in the long run, as we now know. Mm-hmm. There was an interesting little thing that did come up in about 2003. There was a man from Gray that wrote to Danny's family and other Gray residents claiming that he had been molested as a child by a man who did not live far from the Gray home on Route 100 in the 1950s. So he had these letters sent off and they were sent to the police. They, you know, the police did follow up on an investigation and did have a detective assigned to review this new lead, but it doesn't seem like anything has come up of it. The man was named. So they knew that person knew who the man was that molested them, but again, doesn't seem like maybe that person was connected actually.
But interesting thought.
Interesting thought, yeah.
No, I mean, that, yeah. Like, most of the other people the police are looking at are not community members, because most people always think it's not our community. It has to be someone outside of the community who's right. come in, and not looking at the people who have access to children.
Mm-hmm.
Because, though, you know, it's if you are going to be abused, it is generally the people that in your community that you know.
Yeah,
You know, people who hurt you, or people, you are more likely to be hurt by somebody that is closer within your circle, and that's just statistically, how it is.
And it's kind of interesting as well, because it's like I did mention these like three major murderers that were like follow up leads that they were looking into. They did also like look into some sort of random people that were kind of in the area. Like there was a guy that was traveling from Portland. Police questioned that individual, got nothing out of it. There was another individual as well that got pulled over that was found with three boys in his car. That individual was questioned, but it didn't seem like he was connected either. But very suspicious.
Hold on.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yep.
Did they just say, okay, sir, on your way? Were they able to, like, say, he's like, yes, these are my children, or this is my son and his friends? Like, no, just three boys in his car. Oh, very good, sir. These three unrelated boys that are completely unrelated to you, you have a good time. Is that I really hope that's not what happened.
No. Oh, sorry, and I did say earlier that it was a broken handle of a shovel. Sorry, it was a broken handle of a sledgehammer is what they found.
Jesus Christ!
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a full sledgehammer. It was just a handle of a sledgehammer.
No, but what... never mind.
Okay, I know what you're thinking. Anyway. So, no leads. It's been about over 70 years... No, close to 70 years at this point. And still nothing about, you know, where the murder for Daniel Kenneth Wood Jr. is. Quite a bummer of a revelation here, but I thought it was kind of interesting. I did like the conversation a little bit about like this idea of, is today safer or like more dangerous than back then? Not necessarily, but we are talking about these things more.
We discussed Mean World Syndrome on the pod.
I don't think we have.
Are you familiar with Mean World Syndrome?
No.
Okay. So Allegra...
Was that the Mean Girls franchise that never launched?
Yes. Yes, it is. So I believe Allegra took a... Because Allegra's initial interest when she was in school was a communication and media studies. And so she took a couple communications classes. And in one of them, they discussed something called Mean World Syndrome.
Hmm.
I believe, yeah, because she took it was like a social media class. And so the whole thing behind Mean World Syndrome is now that we have the world in our hands, it is so much easier to just believe that the world is dangerous, that people are evil, that humans' basest nature is dark and violent because you see these things come on your feed. Like, let's say that all you listen to is true crime. Of course you're going to feel like a lot of people who listen to true crime, they use it as a way to assuage their fears, to help their anxiety and be like, okay, I can like...
How does this help your anxiety?
Well, as somebody who really leaned into true crime for a really long time, and like it was all I listened to, all I watched, it is this feeling that you are not alone.
Yeah.
There are other people that have stories, and finding solace in the community.
Okay.
So there's a whole lot. People have had long discourse and discussions about why true crime makes us feel the way it does. Like, there are people who fall asleep to true crime podcasts. I did for a really long time. I can't do that right now. I am in a much more sensitive spot than I used to be. But all of this to say, even if you're just a casual person on Facebook or Instagram or, God forbid, Twitter, like me, you see shit. You see shit. Like, something just... Like, there was a whole thing that happened on Twitter recently where there was a crushing video that was going around, and people were just being surprised by the murder of an animal, like on their feed, just very graphic.
Oh, like an animal being crushed?
Yes.
Was it a cattle, yes, or
cat?
Oh,
I was trying not to be, but out there. But yes, so that was going around, and so people on my feed were like, I was getting notifications being like, be super careful when you're scrolling. You know, there's an, like, unfortunately, Twitter also was like, hey, all videos autoplay now. You know, so yeah, that was a whole thing. But it's like, when you have stuff like that, the internet allows people to just upload shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if it's not that far where it's like, oh, these things are showing up on your feed. Like, when you see police brutality or videos of girls being harassed, or even just having news stories.
Yeah.
It is so easy to be like, the world is falling apart. However, in the 50s, you know, your run-of-the-mill citizen in gray Maine might not know that there are protests happening in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
They might not know that a bunch of people were killed in a crowd crush,
right,
in Texas.
Right.
They might not know that refugees off the coast of Pakistan drown.
Yeah.
They might not know all of that.
Right.
And it might be something that they hear about months later once the news gets in their hands.
Right, right.
Via a newspaper. But now it's instantaneous. It happens. Or I think, again, like with the crowd crushes, we have people videotaping it and documenting it.
Yeah.
We have, so you have to sit there and you have to say, are things worse than they were? Or, and it's sort of the same way when we think about actual crimes now, or just like anything in general, like it's better documented, we have better technology, and it's a different world in that way.
Easy kind of little microcosm of that to use as an example. We recently talked about, you know, the train derailment in Ohio. That was huge news. And then I think for weeks and over a month at that point, we would get news of every single train derailment that was happening after Ohio. Now you're probably thinking to yourself, like, if you're just getting this information, oh shit, why is all these trains derailing all of a sudden? But the reality is that it's always been happening. Now we're just paying attention. I think in the US, maybe it's world, don't have the full stat, don't at me, but pretty much over 1,000 train derailments happen every year. And so it's like, and I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't do anything about trains derailing. Of course we should. Yes. And yes, companies should be held to a better standard when it comes to safety, not only for their workers, but everybody else that's around the fucking tracks. So it's like, just because we know that there's more now of, like, now we're more aware of shootings, you know, now we're more aware of murders. It's like, and yeah, it's like tragedy is just like a quick stroke of our finger that we can access. But it's like, but it's always been happening. And I mean, it doesn't make things better or worse, but we should be striving for a better society.
We should, absolutely. But the whole thing of mean world syndrome is, the syndrome part is, you start living your life closed off, afraid, anxious. And so my parting words to you today are, you know, seize the day. But yeah, yes and no. But don't let that sort of thing prevent you from living your dreams, doing what you want, taking trips. It's always great to be mindful and careful. Take care of yourself. Take care of the people around you. But also know that there is good in the world, and you can continue to push good vibes out, good energy, good deeds. And that does make more of a difference than you think it does. So.
Thank you. That was beautiful. And speaking of dreamers, it's time for our next mainism.
Hey, hey, it's a mainism.
What are we talking about?
So we're going to be talking about, I said a little bit earlier that Gray was the site of America's first wool mill.
Ooh.
Ooh. Ooh. So we're going to be talking about the Mayall Woolen Mill.
Woolen Mill.
Which was first introduced by Samuel Mayall. Okay. Yes. Built by Samuel Mayall back in the late 18th century. This was not an above board operation. It was the first wool mill in all of New England back in 1761. Oh, wait, no. He was born in 1761. Fuck!
I was going to say, even so, do you really think OSHA was doing its job then? If it was even around? Like...
Okay, it was 1791, sorry.
I know the bullshit that can... Because having worked in workers' comp, I know the bullshit that can happen when you have safety procedures in place.
Yeah, exactly. Actually,
you imagine see, just like the unfetteredness.
You can see a little example of the woolen mill. It's kind of a couple buildings across. Mm-hmm. Built along a bank, kind of easy access to rail. So a pretty industrious little hub that he ended up building out. Now, what is interesting, though, is that this kind of opportunity was not regulated within America. And there was actually some trade secrets that were held onto by the English that prevented any kind of wool mill from being built out in America. But Mayall, industrious and a little bit, using a little bit of spycraft, decided to smuggle some of this, some schematics and trade secrets in a bundle of cloth destined for the new world. He ended up setting up his shop in New England, settling up in the Collier Brook for his mill. And he ended up having a pretty prosperous business, it seemed, you know, with a little bit of subterfuge. And actually, what's very fun here, a little fun history here, there was an attempt on his life, not once, but twice.
That's the mainest part of all of this, is the assassination attempt.
The English craft guilds were fucking pissed that he took his trade secrets over to America with him. So they decided to go a little acme with their assassination route. The really? First attempt on his life was when the trade guild shipped a hat to him. If you get a hat in a box, what are you going to fucking do with that hat?
What's in the hat?
You can just tell me, what are you going to do with that hat? You get a hat? If I show up with the box and I'm like, hey, B, I got you a hat. Just a hat.
No, I'm scared.
No hard feelings. Here's a hat.
Okay. I'll take the hat.
What do you do with that hat?
I guess I'm going to put it on my head.
Dumb move, B. You'll die. The hat was threaded with little needles dipped in poison. So if he would end up putting that hat onto his little noggin, he would get pricked with the poison and die. But the English trade
are these all? Is this way of murder? Is that patented?
Maybe. I mean,
they should have.
They should have. Yeah, I don't know if that was ever successful, but maybe they're just trying to do what they can. Why don't they just send a guy? But I guess nobody wanted to make the trip. A lot of time to go kill someone, I guess.
Actually, yeah, at that time,
it's
yes.
A lot of, yeah,
actually,
it's like, I gotta dedicate...
A couple months.
I gotta dedicate a whole ass year to killing this guy.
Yeah, I don't think... And it would just sort of... You get to the point where it's like, the pay's not making it. It's not making it. Okay, what's the second one?
Okay, the second attempt at his life was very Acme style. The English Trade Guild sent another box that contained pistols that were rigged in such a fashion that when Samuel would open the box, the pistols would go off shooting him in the face. They failed, though.
Yeah, I would just stop opening the packages that come from the guild.
Yeah, Samuel was very wary of packages from then on out. Samuel ran his mill until 1831 when he died. After his death, two of his three daughters, Mary and Fenella, took over and
Fenella.
Fenella. Yeah, cool name, right?
I like Fenella.
They took over and ran the mill, you know, being, you know, industrious businesswoman. Yeah, and then, you know, the rest of the family went off to go do great things. But what a wild little story that is. The first wool mill full of trade secrets, espionage, and assassination.
That could have been a whole episode.
Could have been a whole episode. But I decided to put it into this.
Here's mechanism. A bite-sized little story for you.
There you go. I probably could have stretched that one out. Yeah, into a full episode. But
you could?
No, I was just looking at some more history. But yeah, sorry. Not important. It was about his son that ended up being a Democrat. Or not a Democrat. Was a Democrat.
The way you said that. His son ended up being a Democrat.
Well, in the 1850s, that wasn't a good thing.
No, I know it wasn't.
He was a Democrat, then became a Republican.
That also just reminds me of John Mulaney. I'm going to be a Democrat.
I'm going to be a Democrat. that's the story of Samuel Millboy. And his woolen mill.
His new name is Millboy.
Millboy. Oh. But I mean, a nice little, you know, kind of a funny little story on top of a very awful story. Well, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of Homegrown Horror. You can go ahead and ask us any little question your tiny little hearts desire over at our email at homegrownhorrorpod@gmail.com. And if you hate email for some reason and only communicate via Instagram, you can go ahead and add us at homegrownhorrorpod.
And As always, if you're interested, you can you can give us 5 stars and drop us a review. But as always, forever and ever, we are just grateful in our hearts, our little hearts, that you are here listening to us. And we are thankful that you just dropped by once again. And we will see you in the next one.
Bye.